Accession number 19855, Reel 5.
Jimmy Lisa, Reel 5.
A vast crowd of people, as far as one can see, all the side streets into this square are thick with them, and they're all brandishing sticks. Or worse, they've picked up paving stones, smashed them on the ground, and they've got the corners and quarters and halves of them, which they're going to use as weapons. And this is usually described in the left-wing press as a peaceful demonstration. And it's clear that at the word, and the word would come from people well far back from the front, shouting the others about freedom, Zindabad, victory, Jai Hind, victory for India, we could be annihilated. And the magistrate bravely reads his piece about the go peacefully to disperse to your homes in English and Gujarati or Hindustani or whatever the language was then. And we are standing really sweating with fear because we can, though we can fire a round or two each, the first people reach us might get killed or wounded. The second certainly won't be, and we're as good as dead. And then suddenly there is a disturbance. Someone is trying to brought a truck into the side of this square. I don't know who or why. And there's a threat of running over someone. And so instantly, with the volatility of an Indian crowd, all the irritation, the anger, the rage, the despair is focused on this other incident where someone's got run down or something, and they abandon us entirely and rush to the other place. And we're left with a truck, the magistrate shouting to a crowd that has just vanished. And I always think of that when I read of these so-called peaceful demonstrations, rioters in this country and in any other country. What the reality is a handful of people not really sure what they should do or even why they're there, but carrying out orders issued in the best interest of all, and a mass of people whose one aim at that time is destruction.
Would this have been 44 or 45?
44. 44. Then get a call back, our orders from HQ, Delhi, to go back into the Public Relations Directorate. So I'm enrolled there as a lieutenant on this paper contact, which comes up twice a week, and my duty was as a sub. And I lived in a tent in a camp, South Avenue camp. South Avenue was one of the avenues between the Commander-in-Chief's building, which is Auchinleck, and the Viceroy, Lord Wewell. And here I have a conundrum. I'm getting, I think, something like, say, 40 rupees a month, no more. I have to pay 30 rupees a month for the hire of the tent, another 30 rupees for a bearer to look after the tent, see it clean, and see my clothes are clean and so on. More for adobe, say 10 rupees for washing. I have to get a bicycle to ride the distances, are so great, I can't walk them all, I can't afford taxis, and that's another 30. And then the mess bill, which is a messing, eating without any drinks or anything, just your food, was another 10 rupees a day, which was 30 day months is 300 rupees. I'm running into debt to you. That's why the lowest rank in Delhi was a captain, because you've got a rise in pay, you could afford these things. I couldn't, I'm just going down the hole. And I tell the people in contact, they don't give a toss. Oh, why should they? I mean, that's not their affair. And I then hear that there are people called Indian Army observers who can be attached to divisions in Burma to write about the divisions which are given to war correspondents who didn't move much out of their base camps, but they get these reports from the observers of each division and they can concoct a story from them, you see. And I put in for this and I'm examined by a woman doctor and she says, well, you're so ill, you shouldn't do this. Well, I said, look, I can't stay here because I'm going to be cashier for no money. I mean, I'm in a ludicrous Kafka situation. I must go. And she says, well, we'll put a blot or something over the rating, your medical thing. So I go back to Burma. Now it's farther on in the war. It's beginning of 45, and I'm a captain now, and I'm attached to 17th Indian Division, a General Crowther, who'd lost his son in the war. There, poor fellow. And I scrounge a jeep. Literally, there are hundreds of jeeps dumped, I don't know why, in a sort of paddy field. And I just go and take one. And in this, with an Indian driver, we drove all over the area where 17th Division was, and we got, I think, more stories into papers than many others. I was the youngest one doing this, and what we did was a very simple thing. We'd go, say, to a light aid detachment, an LAD that mends trucks and so on, and there'd be perhaps 30 British soldiers working there. I'd do a stock story about 50 miles in the Indian jungle and Burmese jungle. There's been a miniature motor company built, etc., or how they work. And then we'd do an interview with each of the men there, so he could say in his local paper, it would appear, that Bombardier Joe Bloggs of 15, the buildings, Plumstead, is working at so-and-so. Then he'd say he was, before the war, he was so-and-so and so-and-so. So you have 30 different stories of the same thing, which was quite a successful way of doing this. And I did that until the end of the war, when I was sent down the same thing to Malaya and then went home. There's one thing earlier on I forgot to say, that after I get my back damaged, I'm given some sick leave, and I went to Calcutta, where there was the hotel there, the Grand Hotel on Chowringhi, Chowringhi, had been apparently abandoned when the Japanese were thought to go into the town. And a clever man called Oberoi, who'd been a clerk in a hotel in the hills,
Darjeeling.
Yeah, somewhere up there. He got backing somehow, and he'd taken over this hotel, and no one wanted it. He got it for very little. Now, it became a leave hostel, so the people coming from India to Calcutta, I think they paid 10 rupees a day, bed, everything else on top. Those coming from Burma, we paid 6 rupees a day. And I remember the bed, I shared it with 3 other people in the bathroom and lavatory. So we lay on the floor in the bathroom come lavatory. And he made a fortune, of course, and then started Oberoi Hotels, and I think went in with the Intercontinental or something. And it was a very enterprising man. Now, in Calcutta, I had some relations by my parents' marriage, who I think I'd met once, living out at Alipore, which is a few miles out. He was something to do with a gunpowder factory in Barrackpore. I think he was one of the directors of this. And I spent a few nights there. But I had no means of getting out there except by taxi, which again was very expensive considering how much one was making, which then was still a lieutenant. In Calcutta, there was a newspaper being published by Frank Owen under Mountbatten's auspices. Frank Owen edited the Evening Standard in London before the war. Was a very charismatic character, youngest Liberal MP in the House of Commons, Welshman, brilliant writer. The great weaknesses were pretty women and eventually drink. But he was incredibly kind to me. And I knocked on the door of this magazine, SEAC, and it got up to his office, which just had "Get Out, F.O.," which could either mean F off or Frank Owen. But I went in, and he gave me a job for my leave, which was very useful because it was a daily paper, this thing, for the troops. And I learned a great deal, which was going to prove useful to me later in life. But to get to Alipore from Calcutta, or get anywhere from this office in Calcutta, needed some means of transport. And old Owen took me to the door or the gate, the window of his office, which overlooked what's called the Maidan, M-A-I-D-A-N, a vast open space, on one corner of which was a car park, which was full of army vehicles and motorbikes. And he said, take your pick. And I said, I couldn't do that. He said, why not? Everyone else does. So I went down to this car park, and dozens of motorcycles. And I just picked one out of the middle, took it off its stand, kick-started it, and took it. And I used it when I was on leave, and I couldn't get petrol at a British petrol point or Indian one because I had no papers, but the Americans are there. And I just went down there and signed the book, sort of Lieutenant Tom Mix, I remember was the name I used, and he put 4 gallons, whatever it was, in the tank of this thing, and I drove it. And I always remember, when I finished, I just put it back. And I suppose others are doing the same. And there's another man I met in Calcutta. I'm walking down Chowringhee, and I see a big Wolseley car coming towards me. And they're very rare to see a big Wolseley, because they're mostly American cars. I look at it, and I see a chap I went to school with, who I'll call Jones, which is not his real name, driving it. And I step out in the road and wave to him, and he's bloody annoyed. He's going a major pips. He says, what do you mean, stopping the car? I said, come on, Jones, you remember me. Good God, he said, Jimmy Lee saw, get in. So I get in, and I don't know where we're going. He said, I've got a flat round here. We go up the main road, Chowringhee, into Park Street, into a big building, parks his car. We got to a lovely flat. There's an Indian in a white monkey jacket. Have a drink. I said, yeah, I love it. He said, what are you doing here? And I said, he said, oh, I'm just, you know, keeping afloat, moving about. But I said, you're a major. I'm only a second lieutenant. We're the same age, same background. How have you done so? He said, I'm not a bloody major. I'm a private. Well, I said, why are you dressed up like this? He said, I'm a deserter. And what had happened was this, that with various others, and Americans especially, they deserted and taken the ranks of these people. The record system was impossible to keep track of everybody. And he and the others were just running the black market. You see, there was a famine in Bengal, and there was a famine, there was a shortage of rice, and there was a shortage of rice, two reasons. One, the rice crop in Burma had not been collected because of the thing, and also thousands of Indian refugees just fled Burma into Calcutta, the nearest place. Now, the average wage then was what I'd paid in Delhi for a bearer, 30 rupees a month, about £7.10 a month. But they got a in service, the people getting this money got their accommodation and some food as well. So it was by no means too bad, considering the English labourers' wages were probably £2.20 a week, not much less. Now, when the Americans come in, they say it's quite wrong that anyone should be paid 30 rupees a month. It's scandalous. They pay 300, which is unbelievable. Now, immediately, the price of the rice goes whip right up to the profiteers. The poor devils who are pulling rickshaws or labourers, they're not getting 300 a month. They're getting 30 still. And they can't get enough food. They're starving, dying, just by the thousand. Americans are idiots. And all the best of intention, but lack of knowledge. And this friend Jones, he was involved with this. And there are other more complex involvements whereby gold was flown over the hump to General Chiang Kai-shek, who was the anti-communist general, was corrupt. His wife was in charge of the Chinese Red Cross. And there was a difference of opinion of where did the money go, the Chinese Red Cross or to the Chiang Kai-sheks, and there was no question where it went. And the Americans flew this over, and in many cases, the planes would land in the jungle at a pre-organized landing strip. The gold would be taken out, boxes filled with earth put back, the plane take off again. And so fortunes were made. And in one case, and I have the newspaper cuttings of it still, and I've used it in a novel. In Bombay, a ship comes in from the States, loaded with these gold bars for Chiang Kai-shek, and also it is unfortunately smoking out of the ventilators on the deck, and they got explosives on there as well. The ventilators have been blocked for some reason. Explosives catch fire, the whole thing blows up, and bars of gold were scattered over the docks of Bombay. And the newspapers didn't mention this at the time. There were 14 acres of docks destroyed. They just said, owing to, you know, sabotage or something. But later on, 20-odd years later, when I was in India, I went in the Times of India office in Bombay and got their newspaper cuttings, their files, and they described this. They did a whole issue on this tremendous explosion where bars of gold fell at the feet of beggars, you know. And some honest men picked up the bars of gold and took them to the police and got nothing for it. Others kept them and made fortunes. It's rather a curious side story.
What exactly was your friend who was the deserter doing on the black market, though?
He was organizing petrol, which could be got from the American sources. He was organizing this rice, which could come in at one price and be sold out at another. And every kind of fiddle that was in progress there. And I would think he made a fortune out of it. To my knowledge, he was never caught. And I say the Americans were on a much bigger scale because of the mafia. We didn't never heard the word the mafia then, but they are all Italian names. They organized things very much. Can I stop?
So it was a question of taking government property or else taking advantage of the difference in price in one area as compared with another.
Yes, that is very... It's harder to take advantage of that than it is to steal. If you steal lorry loads of stuff, you see, I mean food, oil, grain, and it's so difficult to keep track because of the bedlam and the bureaucracy with the place that it was very easy to do that. And a lot did it. As the war progressed and finally ended, I was moved down in Burma to Moulmein, mentioned in Kipling's poem The Road to Mandalay. There's the old Moulmein pagoda looking eastward to the sea. Well, Moulmein was a lovely old city, and I lived in a wooden hut near a temple there. And to the south there was a plantation, a rubber plantation, because it's near fairly near Malaya. And all the vehicles that had been used, captured by the Japanese, civilian cars, lorries, and used by them during the war, were lined up in this plantation. And I was allowed to take my pick of something, and I took a Wolseley 14, and it was numbered on the bumper, and I remember CEV, Captured Enemy Vehicle, number sensor. And every day, the Japanese prisoners would march past where I was, and would collar one of them at the end and put him on cleaning this car, doing something with it. And one day, I'm in my little hut. The car was pretty useless, actually. It was a nice prestige thing, but there were no brakes or something. And an Indian comes in, and he says, I understand you have this car. I said, that's true. He said, I also understand transport was difficult for them, that there are many trucks down in them. And cars in this plantation. I said, yeah. He said it would help us a great deal if we could buy those to help the country rebuild, you see. Well, I said, I'm sure it will, but I can't help it. He said, I would be in a position to offer you, it was the equivalent of £70,000, which was an unbelievable sum. And believe me, in 1945, if I could get those trucks. Well, I said, I couldn't, there's nothing to do with me, they're all... Perhaps their owners will come back after the war. I assure you, if I could help you, I would, but I can't. He said, it's a great sum of money, and you're a young man. I said, it is, but, you know, I've got the King's Commission. I can't do that. I'm sorry, you see. And we parted on cool terms. No. I've been out there altogether 3 years, 4 months, and I'm posted in Malaya, and then to go home. And young fellow arrives. I call his name, not Jones, who can I call him now? Bloggs arrives, another captain, but rather much smoother than me. He's got sort of sombre-skinned boots. He's got beautifully cut, not old jungle green things, but khaki drill, bush jacket, trousers, well-pressed, brass pips on his shoulder, moustache. He's a very smooth character. And he said, anything I should know? I said, yes, there's an Indian wandering right here who's offered me £70,000 for all those cars and trucks in the field. I said, that's absolute nonsense. You take them, you get cashiered if you're caught. They're not ours to sell. Anyhow, it's absurd. We're supposed to be liberating this place. You can't be flogging. It's ludicrous. God, he said, I'll give that bastard if he comes around here. I won't have him at all. Thanks for warning me, Dodgy. I go to Malaya, come back to England. I go and see the local paper, and they now offer me £4 a week. I thought, oh, no, I can't do that. That's ridiculous. I then go and see my sister and her husband, who are doctors in Somerset, and they have got a book by a man, Peter Howard, who is a moral rearmament Buckmanite or something. And he had a book about his life, Ideas Have Legs, describing how he joined the Daily Express and worked for Beaverbrook, and he was getting thousands a year before the war. That's incredible. How he went to Oxford. I thought, I'll go to Oxford. And I wrote to the secretary of Oxford University, how naive one was. And I got asking particulars of entry. I got a great thick book saying the subjects you could offer for like Hebrew and all this stuff. And I write to every college in the book, I think they're 28. And most, this is June 1946, most write back and say, we're sorry, all our places are taken. Two, Brazenose and Oriel, say, come up and see them. Well, I go up my little MG, which I bought, and I go to see Oriel first in the morning, and a lot of dons, several dons there. And they say, if you came to Oriel, Mr. Leeson, what sort of career would you fancy following? I thought of reading English, you see. I said priggishly, not thinking of writing books and make money, I said, I'd like a career in letters. And one of the younger ones said, are you sure you don't mean a career in French letters? I said, well, that'd probably pay a lot better. And I'd tell them the story of the man with the kit bag and the troop ship. And so they said, well, Mr. Leister, I think we can say you've been accepted. And so I go to Brazenose in the afternoon and thank them and say I've been accepted by Oriel. And I was delighted. I drove back my little MG to area. I thought, anyone can do this. It was amazing. I didn't realize how lucky I was. Now, I go to Oriel that October 1946. Share a room with some fellow. Nice chap. And going across the quad, to my astonishment, I see Bloggs, who's now beautifully dressed, not any rational clothes, but trousers and Dax trousers, superb sports coat, so, you know, yellow polo neck sweater, really the bee's knees. And I said, Carl, you're so and so. And he said, I don't think I know. I said, you remember the Moulmein? And he looks at me in horror, and he says, yes. I said, tell me, I often wondered, what happened to all those trucks? He said, I sold the lot. And he's now immensely rich in this country, was a member of Lloyd's. I think he probably must have lost a lot, but he had an estate and house in Belgravia and everything.
So does that mean you were an undergraduate studying English literature? Or
yeah, I was, and I fulfilled an aim I'd had since boyhood, when I'd read some book by Beverly Nichols, 25, I think it was his autobiography, and I edited The Isis, which I was very pleased, and my experience on the various papers I'd served, the Kentish Times, Contact, and SEAC, was very useful. And my book had come out and done reasonably well, and when my time came to leave Oriel, I thought I'd can't make a living writing books, as paper was rationed. I'll try and get a job in a newspaper. And I wrote to the Times, got a very civil letter, but nothing. I wrote to the Sunday Times, then under separate ownership. nothing there. I wrote the Daily Express, and I got a letter from the editor, Arthur Christensen, saying, come up to London, such and such a date, for an interview. Take a five bob return coach, Royal Blue coaches, to London, and get offered a job as a reporter, a month's trial. And in that month, I was lucky enough to have one or two good stories, and I stayed there for 7 years.
How do you feel now about having served in the army in the Second World War?
It's not on, is it?
Yes.
How do I feel? Well, I'm very glad I did it. I mean, I know lots of I know several people of my generation who kept out of things by going deliberately into reserved occupations. And I've always felt, I think in the word of, was it Dr. Johnson, every man feels meanly of himself for not having been a soldier. I may misquote that, but I think it was Johnson. And I made a lot of good friends in the army. I had a lot of good times and experiences, all of which have proved invaluable to me in my life and my job. And above all, I think I've learned that when people do you a bad turn, it's often not because they dislike you or they want to get their own back on you or something. It's something in their life that has happened that has made them like that. And it's one of Aesop's fables, my son's quote to me, about a horse and a scorpion. Do you know that?
No.
There's a horse and a scorpion standing on the side of a river which has risen its banks, is going to flood them both. And the scorpion says to the horse, look, you're a big animal, I'm a small one. If I stay here, I'm going to get drowned. Give me a lift, I beg of you, to the other side where we can get up to the hills. And the horse says to the scorpion, if I do that, I know you lot, you'll sting me. No, I won't sting you. I'd be so grateful to get a lift. So the horse says, get aboard. He wades into the water, starts to swim. As they get in the middle, the scorpion stings him in the back, causing his death. And as he threshes about dying, he says, why did you do that? Why you kill us both? And the scorpion says, I couldn't help it. It's because I'm a scorpion. It's a good point, I think, to make.